Before we get started, there's a lot of text today, so for my note takers, I probably ain't got enough for everybody, but hopefully it'll make an easier life on my note takers. Here's some printed version, take one, pass one around, share with your neighbors. As those are going, like Brother David, I found out yesterday that this group ain't afraid to share comments and feedback and thoughts. So we'll see how many of them we keep on pushing for the rest of the week. Obviously, the Western Wall, that's it. I always found it interesting, just a little piece of trivia as we get started. In Judaism, the Western Wall is more important than the Temple Mount itself, because this is where you can get the close as possible to the most holy place. That's why it's considered more important than the Holy Mount. Not that the Temple Mount's not important, but the Western Wall is considered more so. So our theme verse today is, as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, what shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world?" These are the three parallel accounts we'll be working from today. There is no way you can read that on this slide, but that's some of the sources that I drew from. So if you get my PDF, or if you've got the handout, you probably don't even have those on the handout. I was trying to save the paper. So, I'm also kind of gratified our timing seems to be working well between me and Brother David. I'm skipping a couple hundred years, and he's going to fill in the interim in his class with me, I think. So, we're going to be really dealing with a critical topic today. This is one of the most important events in the history of Jerusalem. And we're primarily going to work out of the Matthew account, but we'll reference the parallel accounts as well. I'll mention as we go through this my views, but also mention some of the views of other Christadelphians and their comments on this, particularly because you may have some of their books in your library. So I'll be throwing out some names occasionally here and there. As I said, we're going to be predominantly working out of Matthew, but before we start there, I would like to start in Mark, because he adds this little bit of color in his record that I think is really interesting. The parallel account is Mark 13:1. See if I come through okay? All right. 13:1 says, "As he went out of the temple, one of his disciples saith unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." If you're not familiar with it, up behind me here is a scale model of Jerusalem during the second period temple time. It's in the Israeli Museum. Thank you, Luke. To give you an idea of the scale, that back there in the corner is a full-size door. Over here, there's a bench underneath these trees, right? So this is a fairly large model. And what the view you have right here is actually the view that Jesus and the apostles would have had from the Mount of Olives when they're looking at this. And I like the Mark account because you can just read into this statement the absolute awe and astonishment and just unbelievable setup that from the apostles' comments, right? We have to remember they're from a small fishing village town, right? They are from a small community. They're from the rural area, and they are seeing this giant complex, which, by the way, was created by Herod to be one of the greatest temples in the world, right? In all the Roman Empire, this is a spectacular sight, right? And so in this context of this spectacular sight, this is us as tourists going to see, I don't know, pick something, the Great Wall of China, the Eiffel Tower, something like that. That's on this kind of scale that they are just floored and amazed that something can be this big and this beautiful and this grand. And in this context, they ask a simple thing about how great it is. And what does Jesus say in response? He says, "Seest thou these buildings? There shall not be one left. Shall not be one left, one stone left upon another that shall not be thrown down." So turn with me to Matthew 24. And I'm going to read verses 1 to 3 to get us started. "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and the disciples came to him to show him the temple, the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See not all these things. Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world?" So what we have here is the Olivet prophecy, of course, that is in response to this query by the apostles in verse 3. So the first step that we're going to do is to simply break down this question. In Matthew, here it appears that there's three questions in the way it reads. And if you were to read Mansfield's commentary on the story of the Bible, he comes very strongly in favor of a three-question approach and tries to answer each. However, to my mind, there's only two questions up here when I look at this. And I have them up on the screen. The first is, when will these things be? The second question is, what will be the sign? Luke and Mark ask about all the things that Matthew provides, and specifically all the things that include thy coming and the end of the world. So in my mind, we have two questions here, right? The sign, or the time, and the sign about thy coming and the end of the world. So we have our two questions. Let's try to break these down a little bit more by diving into the words that are used in these questions, because these become really critical. So the first question is, when will these things be? And I have it up here. The Greek word is pote, and it means how long and at what time. In effect, the apostles, in my mind, are asking, how long will it be until the destruction of the temple? That's their question. Because it was Jesus' prophecy about the destruction of the temple that prompted their questions, right? Like, that's the most natural follow-on. He just told them it was going to be thrown down. And that's a really logical question to say, how long before this happens? Because the fact the temple was going to be destroyed must have been exceptionally shocking to the apostles. Right? They just saw what is one of the greatest structures in the world. Not only is it just such a magnificent place, but think about how Jeremiah reacted in Lamentations to the destruction of the temple. Think about things like Psalm 79 that bemoan its destruction. This is even going to turn out to be one of the false charges that they level against Jesus at his trial, right? Like, this is not a light throwaway comment of like, oh yeah, this is going to be torn down. That is massive, earth-shattering, something that probably couldn't have been, I mean, not only would it have been unfathomable, it would have been alarming to them to even think that that would be possible, right? So that's their first question. The second question, I also think, is a natural reaction to the prophecy. The apostles believe that Jesus is the Messiah. They believe he is the king that will restore the nation of Israel. And he just told them the temple is going to be destroyed. They need to figure out how to reconcile and fit all of that into their minds. Because right on the surface of it, if you put yourself in their shoes, those two things don't match, right? How can we have a kingdom? How can we have you be the Messiah if this thing's going to go away? Now, a sign is simply a token or indicator that distinguishes an event or person that makes it obvious that this is really something important. You know, the same word as the sign the shepherds had found the infant Messiah was that he was to be in a manger. The sign Judas gave to identify Christ was a kiss, right? This is the type of sign they are asking for. They're looking for something that's very obvious to do an identification. And it's worth highlighting this word sign because Jesus is going to use it in his response. Let's dive in a little bit more into the second question too. Because it's really important to understand the Greek word that Jesus is using, the Greek word here that's really interesting. The Greek word for coming here is parousia. It's up on the slide, it's in your handout, so I don't have to spell it for y'all. Or y'all have to guess how it's spelled. Parousia. It means the literal presence of a person. This is how Paul uses it in several of his letters when he talks about being literally with the Philippians or the arrival of Titus to visit him, right? He is talking about a literal arrival, right? That's one meaning of parousia. But that's really not how the apostles are using it in this sense because Jesus is right there with them already. He's literally with them. That's not the way they're using it. Parousia in Matthew is being used in a technical sense. And in the Greek-speaking world, a parousia was the official visit or arrival of a king to a city, a country, or region. This is the literal coming of a king to a location. And if you think about what all that entails, that's a very dramatic event. That city or location, they had to start getting ready for the king showing up by collecting taxes in advance. They had to get supplies and stores ready. Once a king arrived, it was the time for the king to start handing out judgments to the local population, giving out rewards. It was for rights and petitions for people to come forward and get acted on. In some locations, when the king showed up, they would even start changing their calendar and start counting the days since the arrival of so-and-so, the emperor's visit, right? This is a new way of even marking time. So in the passages noted here, this term is correctly applied to Christ's second coming. That is his literal return to become king. It's got the literal aspect of him being there, which is very important for us, and the arrival as king aspect. So doctrinally, this has always been critical, right? Parousia means literally there in person. Parousia, this word, does not allow for any kind of idea of heaven going or having Christ as king in the kingdom anywhere else other than earth, right? We know that this visit, this is arrival, his coming is what we have to get ready for. Now, just as a kind of comment here, when we read this question, we have to be a little careful. The apostles are not, I stress, not asking, when will be your second coming? That's not what they're asking. They're simply asking, when will you arrive in Jerusalem as king? And I guess the point I'm trying to make is, while Christ's arrival as king will occur at his return, the apostles don't know that, right? We don't want to read into their question, when will be your second coming? That's not what they're asking. Remember that the apostles did not understand or accept that Christ was going to be crucified. They didn't understand that he was going to ascend to his heavenly Father. They didn't know that he would eventually return. They didn't understand or know any of that, right, at this time. So we don't want to impose our later knowledge that Christ had two, for lack of a better term, advents on this question. They don't know that. I mean, I think, like, even my Bible, my King James says something like the glorious return or the second coming is one of the section headings. Like, that's us knowing what's happening and interjecting back. They are just asking, what is the sign that will be you taking on your role as king? They don't understand it's going to have this interim in between. Okay. We also have here the end of the world, which properly means the end of the age. In scriptures, we have the current age, the kingdom age, even references to the Mosaic age. So the apostles are asking, when will this age be replaced with the kingdom age? They know those two things come together, right? The arrival of the Messiah, the arrival of the king, was the end of the world, right? Period. They understand that. But again, I don't think we want to interject our later understanding. I don't believe they are asking, when will be the end of the Mosaic age or the end of the Mosaic law, right? They knew that the Messiah's arrival would end, or believed that the Messiah's arrival would end the Roman occupation. They knew the world would begin anew, there would be a new age, but I don't think they necessarily saw it as the law ending, right? Or the Mosaic age coming to an end. You may read that occasionally. They didn't really see that. You know, remember, keeping to the law was the first big issue facing the first century ecclesia, right? They all still wanted to keep it. They thought they had to keep it. They wanted to. To be fair, when we read passages in Ezekiel, we see that there will be sacrifices in the kingdom age. So it makes sense for them thinking that the law wasn't necessarily going to end, right? They had to have that taken away from them. They want to know in this question, when will the messianic age begin? So with these two questions, we want to be careful about injecting any of our understanding onto the apostles that they did not yet have. I don't think you all want to hear me read giant long passages, so I'm going to turn to Brother Dan's row. Would you all read Matthew 24 through 31 for us? I know it's a long section. Maybe do five verses or so. Matthew 25, 3 through 31. 24. Matthew 24. Ignore me. Listen. Read what's on the slide. Not what comes out of my mouth. Matthew 24. Thank you.
All right, verse 3. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there shall be famine and pestilence and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall arise and shall deceive many.
And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains, and him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day.
For then shall be a great tribulation, which was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor never shall be. And except those days shall be shortened, there shall no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. And if any man shall say unto you, Lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christ and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, Behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east, and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of the trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other.
Thank you all for that. That helps me out quite a bit. So here is a suggested outline for the Olivet prophecy based on following Matthew 24's account. So we're going to work through each of these sections and also kind of weave in Mark and Luke's accounts as well. But I wanted to share the overall outline first because we can't fit the whole thing with all the verses on the screen, hence the couple of pages of handouts. And just as a note, the outline I'm going to present fits pretty closely as the one suggested by Alfred Norris in his commentary, The Gospel of Mark, if you have that book. So if you don't have it already, which I assume most of us do, Matthew 24 is where we're going to be, so you can follow along in each section, and I'll let you decide if you agree with me or not. First, Christ gives an exhortation and several events in response to the question, right? How long until the destruction of the temple? That's our working question. We're going to start by working through that. So verse 4 through 8, I would contend, is really a warning and an exhortation. We have the warning to the apostles not to be led astray by those claiming to be the Messiah in the coming years. And it would appear, the fact of the matter is that, you know, Jews under the Romans were inspiring a lot of false messiahs, and some pretty notable ones. For example, in Acts chapter 5, the rabbi Gamaliel mentions both Thaddeus and Judas, who drew away people, right? That they were drawing people away as rebels. Josephus mentions more in his history as well, as people who were rising up messianic-type rebellions against the Romans. In verses 6 to 7 in Matthew, we have the admonition not to be concerned or not to be troubled with events and wars of the world. We understand, of course, the view of earthquakes to be metaphorical for disruptions in powers and structures of the world. And I think this section serves as a preamble to the answer because, and that's pretty clear from verse 6, because if you look at verse 6, it states, but the end is not yet. Likewise, verse 8 summarizes all of these events as just as being the beginning of sorrows. Or more accurately, that beginning of sorrows should be translated the beginning of birth pains. And birth pains are frequently used in Scripture to describe the onset, and I guess by merely my association, of pain with such a momentous event. In all of these examples, the event is dramatic and involves violence. Jesus admits there will be wars, famines, earthquakes, etc. But that they should note as indicate, none of these indicate how long. That isn't measuring the passage of time. It's just saying they will happen. With this preamble, I think the next section begins. This is section, I would think it's probably 19 or 14. Keep your hand in Matthew here before we get into that. But flip back over to Mark 13. And I want us to look at verse 3. And Mark 13:3 says, "And he sat upon the Mount of Olives over against the temple. Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately," in verse 4, "Tell us, when shall these things be?" Now, everything is recorded for our benefit, right? There is application to us. But we must remember, as we're reading this, Jesus is talking to his apostles. And in fact, he's not talking to a large group of all of his disciples. He's really only talking to four of them here, right? And so go back to Matthew 24. And if we think about it, this next session, Matthew 24, 9 to 14, thereabouts, is really a catalog of what these apostles and the other first century believers are going to experience. Specifically, it's going to be these apostles, right? Look at Matthew 24, verse 9. "Then they shall deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. James was killed by Herod. Peter and Paul most notably end up imprisoned a lot," right? "But all the apostles are put in front of councils and threatened. Peter's killed in Rome, most likely. We have on the screen the parallel account in Luke. And just by running over your eyes over it, I think you can see how well this matches with events recorded in Acts. I try to highlight and call them out. So James killed by, they deliver up and shall kill you. James killed. Peter and the others imprisoned. Paul before the Roman governors, right? All brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. Next, in verses 10 and 12, we have the warning of the coming apostasy and the falling away. In verse 13, we have an admonition and promise to stay strong. And I have verse 14 kind of in this section and the next section of this outline. But let's look at verse 14. It reads, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." So inclusive of everything that is to happen before the answer to the question, when shall these things be, we have all of those events, all of those trials, and then we have the preaching of the gospel to the world. Now first, this, I'll just play with that if it's in my hand. First, this is not the entire globe. This word is oikumenēa, which means world, which in Greek writings is often the portion of the world that is inhabited by the Greeks. That is in distinction from the world that is inhabited by the barbarians. And the Greek writing authors who wrote about the Roman Empire, it is equivalent to the Roman Empire. Right? So this is what this word means. It means this known world, this Greek inhabited world, the Roman Empire. That is, of course, what the apostles did. They spread the gospel. They even went beyond this, but they went to that. So I think Mark's account actually reinforces this preaching is about the apostles. Look at Mark. Keep your hand here again. Go back to Mark 13. Mark 13, verse 10. In Mark's presentation, It's in the midst of all of those things that are happening, right? Like if you go back to look at verse 9, right? Take heed to yourselves, for they deliver you up into councils, synagogues, beaten, testimony for kings, right? Then it must be published in front of all nations. And then when you stand up to be delivered beforehand, in reference to those councils, in reference in front of those kings, it's inside that list, right? It makes it sound like it's much more stuff that's going to happen to them and it's their responsibility. So this is all about events occurring during the first century and particularly to the apostles. So in Matthew 24, Matthew 14, that ends with the phrase, "And then shall the end come." So now we get to really the answer of the question, when shall these things be, right? He said, all that stuff's going to happen, but that doesn't mark the end. That doesn't tell you the progress of time. But when those things happen, then the end comes. And so we're going to get to the answer to one of our questions here. When is the destruction of the temple? This is where we really have to lean on the parallel account in Luke. Both Matthew and Mark mention the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. They also both add the parenthetical editorial, who readeth, let him understand. Right? That is right there in verse 15 of Matthew chapter 24. Luke, who is writing predominantly for a Gentile convert audience, does not assume his audience has the depth of understanding of Old Testament prophets to simply say, I'm going to mention something that Daniel said. He includes the explanation that the abomination of desolations is equivalent to Jerusalem being encompassed by armies. Luke provides the interpretation for us. I mean, let's just go ahead and look at it, right, shall we? It says there on Luke 21:20, "And when ye shall see Jerusalem encompassed with armies, know that the desolation thereof is nigh." Again, this is a brief aside. In the series of stories on the stories of the Bible, I think Mansfield does a reasonable job explaining, or maybe he imagines, the conversations between Jesus and the apostles that would let our Lord to use both terms and have one apostle record it and then Luke use a different term. If you want to see how he kind of imagines that conversation, it's there. I won't go through it, but I think it's reasonable that Jesus could have said both. So in his response, Jesus has told the apostles when they should expect to see the temple destroyed. When it's encompassed by armies, that's when they should expect to see it. Let's go through this in detail and establish that this is going to be the Roman destruction of AD 70. So, the phrase abomination of desolation appears three times in Daniel in two different contexts. The first is the 70 weeks prophecy, and the second is in the King of the North and the South prophecy. As a note, there is inconsistency in nearly every single commentary about which one Jesus is alluding to when he makes this reference. Some is going to point to the 70 weeks, some will point to Daniel 11, others will point to both. Regardless, thanks to the parallel account in Luke, we're going to end up in the same place with the same conclusions. So we'll talk. That's not what I wanted to do. So we'll first take the 70 weeks prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. Daniel 9, 27. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. For the overspreading of abominations shall he make it desolate, even until the consummation, and the determined shall be poured upon the desolate. The translators of the King James Version had a little trouble with this section, but if you compare the Septuagint and an interlinear Greek New Testament, like the Diaglot, you will see that this is exactly the same phrase, that overspreading of abominations is the abominations of desolations. It's the same phrase. It's just the King James people liking to change words for no reason. So we know the 70 weeks prophecy is about the timing of the Messiah and his work. Within this critical prophecy, we get when the Messiah was to appear. We get to find out that he would be cut off during the week, and that his work would remove the need for sacrifices under the law of Moses, and that he would confirm the covenant. This is a really critical prophecy about Christ. I am not going to read the entire 70 weeks prophecy and get into all the detail, but we'll try to just hit some highlights of it here. First, we understand traditionally that verse 26 also refers to Christ. Verse 26 reads, "And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, and for the people of the prince shall come and destroy the city of the sanctuary, and the end shall be with a flood, and the end of war and desolation determined." Right? The prince is Christ, and of course the Messiah is Christ. "And the army that comes against the city are the Romans, who are extracting judgment against the nation for their rejection of God's Son, as foretold in Deuteronomy 28. This feature occurs after the 70 weeks have passed, right? After his sacrifice. Likewise, the abomination of desolation occurs after the 70 weeks as well. On this event, Brother Thomas wrote the following in the exposition of Daniel. He said, "Since the days of vengeance which came upon Judah 38 years after the ending of the 70 weeks, various abominations have rested like winged birds upon the land. These have all been of a desolating character, such as the Roman, Greek, Persian, Syrian, and Ottoman abominations." What we have with Christ's words here is a pointer in this prophecy to impending destruction. Right, for those listening to him on the Mount of Olives. The abomination of desolation is also referenced in Daniel 12, but it's within the prophecy of the king of the north and the south. Daniel 11. We'll look at Daniel 11, verses 30 to 32. "For the ships of Chittim," I'm picking up in the middle of a lot of history, so just bear with me and trust me on some of the background. Or check me later on some of the background. "For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and shall return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do, and he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place abomination that maketh desolate, and shall do wickedly against the covenant, shall be corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits." So here we have the king of the north rebuked by the ships of Chittim, which is actually, so this is one of the great, like, great dramatic events in history. We'll get to Antiochus Epiphanes, but the king of the north, we'll name him in a second, but the king of the north is marching south against Egypt, and Egypt calls to Rome. They send ships of Chittim, Rome. One senator from Rome, no armies, just one senator from Rome, walks up and meets in front of this advancing army from the north. He takes a stick, goes up to the king of the north, draws a line in the sand. King of the north is walking forward to greet him. Senator doesn't say anything, just draws a line in the sand and says, "If you step over this line, you're at war with Rome." King of the north looks at the line, turns around and walks back home, and does not invade Egypt simply based on one senator's threat of war with Rome. And after that humiliation, the king of the north is going to take out his pain on the sanctuary and set up the abomination of desolations. This is the exact same phrasing as Daniel 9. In the exposition of Daniel, Brother Thomas identifies this king as Antiochus Epiphanes. He's not the only one to do this, of course, since I just told you the story. Lots of people have identified this event as the event precipitating the Maccabean revolt. In his commentary on chapter 11, Brother Thomas has this interpretation on verse 31. I won't read all of his additional comments. They're there for if you want it. But he writes the following. As soon as Antiochus returns from Antioch, he published by decree which all of his subjects were required to conform to the religion of the state. As soon as he arrived in Jerusalem, he began suppressing the daily or evening morning sacrifice. The details of this event are recorded in the first book of Maccabees. It's, of course, apocryphal, but it's considered a good, reliable history. That book writes the following about Antiochus Epiphanes, which you see up there, minus his nose. He fell suddenly upon the city and smote it very sore and destroyed much of the people of Israel. And when he had taken the spoils of the city, he set it on fire and pulled down the houses and walls thereof on every side. Thus they shed innocent blood on every side of the sanctuary and defiled it. Her sanctuary was laid waste like a wilderness. Her feasts were turned into mourning, her Sabbaths into reproach, her honor into contempt. Now on the 15th day of the month of Kisew, in the 145th year, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar and builded altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side and burned incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. And when they had rent in places the books of the law they found, they burned them with fire. And whosoever was found with any book of the Testament or any committed to the law, the king's command was they should be put to death. Josephus, in his commentary on this event, simply states the king came upon the Jews with a great army and took their city by force and slew it with a great multitude. So whether we take Christ's pointer to the abomination of desolations as either part of the 70 weeks prophecy, or we take it to the historical events associated with Antiochus Epiphanes in Daniel chapter 11, and the Maccabees, we end up in the same place. A destructive army is coming to forcibly end sacrifices and destroy this temple. That is reinforced by Luke's Jerusalem encompassed by armies interpretation statement. They are both warning about armies and destruction. I think it's personally a reference to the 70 weeks. But again, you end up at the same place. Armies and destructions is what's coming. That is the answer to the question, when. And we've got a few minutes left, so we'll cover this. I think this section concludes with the description and warning about the, going back to Matthew, sorry, back to the, all the prophecies and the words of Jesus in Matthew 24. I think this section concludes with a description about the severity that was to come with that destruction of the temple. In all three accounts, I think the... Let's just look at this. Look at verse 16, right? Matthew 24. In verse 15, it says the destruction... Destruction by Daniel, the prophets, we did have the destruction. Verse 16 says, then let them which in the mount, blah, blah, let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. In all three accounts, the first message after the announcement of the destruction coming is the instruction to flee. This is always, in all three accounts, this is the first message. And I think it illustrates the great concern Christ is showing for his disciples, he is telling them simply and plainly, he's saying, run. The remainder, not on a Sabbath day, flight in winter, or going back to the house, is all about getting away as fast as possible. Luke adds the detail about this duration of the downtrodden of the downtrodden Jerusalem will last until the time the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, Josephus describes how really terrible the siege and destruction of Jerusalem was. Inside the city, rebellion was being led by warlords who were frequently fighting amongst themselves. The people were starving. Outside the city walls, the Romans are crucifying up to 500 Jewish prisoners a day to encourage surrender from the city. After a battle on the Temple Mount, the temple catches fire and is burned by Roman soldiers. Josephus records the following. Afterwards, while this holy house was on fire, everything was plundered that came to hand. 10,000 of those that were caught were slain, nor was there any commiseration for age, any reverence of gravity, but children and old men, profane persons and priests were all slain in the same manner, so their war went around all sorts of men and brought them to their destruction, as well as those who made supplication for their lives, as for those that defended themselves by fighting. Josephus records that the number of prisoners taken in the entire war was 97,000. The number that died during the siege was 1.1 million. The large number is because the siege occurred during the Passover celebration, which so many Jews from other countries had been in the city before the siege began, right? The city's population had swelled, and then the siege goes on. After the city, Josephus goes on to say the following. He says, now as soon as the army had no more people to slay or plunder, because there remained none of their objects of the fury, right? For they would not have spared any had there remained any work to be done. Caesar gave orders that they should now demolish the entire city and temple, but should leave as many of the towers standing as were of the greatest embassy. In order to demonstrate to posterity what kind of city this was, how well fortified, which the Roman valor had subsumed. But for all the rest of the wall, it was so thoroughly laid even with the ground by those that dug it up to the foundation that there was left nothing to make them that came thither believe that it ever had been inhabited. This was the end which Jerusalem came by the madness of those that were innovations, a city otherwise of great magnificence and of mighty fame among all mankind. I'm sure you all have seen this image before. This is Titus's triumphal arch, which is in Rome. It's in the Forum. You can walk right up to it, take a picture with it, and see it. Of course, this is the Romans taking spoils from the destroyed temple, right? Them walking out with the lampstand. The destruction was utter and extensive, and really almost unbelievable how much the city was flattened. At this point, we have the answer to the first question, how long until these things be? We're going to pause there, and we'll try to answer the next question, when shall be the sign of thy coming tomorrow? Thank you.